We're talking about the doctrine of predestination this morning. It's found in our text in Romans chapter 8 and verse 29, where Paul says, "For whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate." You see? Predestinate to be conformed to the image of his Son. Now, last week we talked about the doctrine of election, which is a doctrine widely rejected by the world of sinners in particular. It's a doctrine widely rejected by most religions. And unfortunately, it's a doctrine that is widely avoided, if not rejected, even in evangelical churches and by pastors and by some theologians. But we tried to show last week that our God is a choosing God, and that he even chooses those whom he will save. The Bible is very clear that God has chosen some for the purpose of making them holy and without blame before him. Flip over to Ephesians chapter 1. Ephesians chapter 1, verses 4 through 6. Let's just read it out of our Bibles. That's the place that you really want to see it, isn't it? "According as he hath chosen us in him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before him, in love having predestinated us," there's the word, "in love having predestinated us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to himself, according to the good pleasure of his will, to the praise of the glory of his grace, wherein he hath made us accepted in the beloved." You can certainly look around at the world of sinners and be sure that God has not chosen all to have sins forgiven and to be like Christ. But he has a people whom he has chosen, and God is doing a great work of salvation in their souls. And he's doing a work of transformation in their lives. And he's working all things together for good to them that are called. And he will ultimately complete the work of salvation with respect to the elect. And all of God's elect will come to Christ and will finally be glorified for all eternity. But we come now this morning to another doctrine which walks hand in hand with election, and which likewise is generally rejected by men. And that doctrine is the doctrine of predestination. Now, when we talk about the doctrine of predestination, we sometimes think of it in very limited terms, as though God only predestinates in the area of salvation. And indeed, when the Bible uses this word, it's usually in the context of saving sinners, saving his elect. But in other words, God has predestined, some say, those whom he will save. That's certainly true. And that's what our text in Romans 8 is about. Paul is saying that God has predestinated that his elect will be called and justified and glorified and remade in the image of Christ. But the theological concept of predestination goes far beyond the limited area of soteriology. The fact of the matter is that God has predestined far more than the salvation of the elect. God has predestined how many things? All things. It says in Ephesians 1:11, "In whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestinated according to the purpose of him who worketh" what? "All things after the counsel of his own will." Notice that he doesn't merely work saving things according to his own will, but he works all things according to his own will. So we want to take a look this morning at the broad concept of predestination. And I'd like to say, first of all, that predestination is a necessary element of a biblical worldview. And I think this is the real problem that the world has with the concept of predestination. The world of sinners has rejected God. It has adopted the notion of a universe without a creator and a world without a sustainer and a world which somehow manages and governs itself. To the world of lost sinners, it is quite offensive to suggest that a holy God is in charge. And so they adopt a worldview that is not a biblical worldview at all. But as Christians who accept God's word as ultimate and absolute truth, we are not laboring under those false conceptions that permeate the world. We come to this great concept of predestination with a biblical worldview that makes predestination seem not only reasonable and palatable, but necessary. The biblical concept of God Himself makes the doctrine of predestination easy to swallow, if not easy to understand. We are not naturally disposed to reject it if we're Christians, you see. We haven't rejected the concept of an all-powerful God who can do all things. And so we are not predisposed against this great doctrine of God, which assigns absolute control of the universe to God Himself. As Christians who read and believe the Bible, we have three bedrock truths that shape our understanding of the world. And we can't be shaken from it. No, we cannot be shaken from it by college professors who have rejected God, nor by scientists who don't believe in God, or by religious leaders dressed up in robes and colors. God has straightened out our thinking by His Word, and He has set us on a course headed in the opposite direction from those without a biblical compass. Here are three biblical concepts which shape our overall perspective of the world and which dispose us to believe and understand the doctrine of predestination. First of all, we believe that God planned the world and created it by design. The world didn't just pop out of nowhere and out of nothingness without a designer. God wasn't sitting in His heaven one day looking out His window when, much to His surprise, a universe exploded into existence. God didn't raise hands and say, "How did that happen?" He didn't say, "Now what do I do?" Rather, we know from the Scriptures that God planned the world and He created it according to His plan. It says in Genesis 1:1, the very first verse of the Bible, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth." God created the universe by His own volition and by His own omnipotence. He intended to do it, and He did it with a plan in mind. This concept of God and His universe is the biblical concept of things. And anyone who rejects the biblical account of things is staggering around at sea without a compass. But not God's people. We know that God created the universe by design and by a plan. But secondly, we also believe that God sustains His creation, and this is what the Bible teaches. He doesn't sit in heaven with His arms crossed doing nothing. God isn't waiting to see if the world will hold together for a few more days. God isn't anxious and nervous about it. God doesn't see a meteor headed for the earth and say, I sure hope that meteor doesn't hit the earth. Rather, our God sustains the universe by His awesome power and by His continual work. In fact, by divine authority, the work of sustaining all things falls on Jesus Christ Himself. Speaking of Jesus in Colossians 1:17, Paul says, and He, that is Jesus, is before all things, and by Him all things consist. How many things hold together because of Him? All things. So by His continual work, we believe that God planned the world and that He sustains the world. And then as a bedrock fundamental of our biblical worldview, we believe that God governs His creation. God does not abdicate His throne ever. God rules His universe perfectly with righteous judgment and with infinite wisdom and with an impeccable blend of justness and mercy. Even when sinners sin, God is in control. You might remember from the Old Testament, the Assyrians came down to plunder Israel, and they were nothing more than the rod of God's discipline. In another case, wicked Jews and ignorant Gentiles crucified Jesus Christ, and yet they were unwittingly carrying out the determinate counsel of God. Is God ever out of control? No! Take a look at Acts chapter 2. Acts chapter 2, 22 and 23. This is an amazing couple of verses here, which throws non-believers into consternation. They can't understand it. They can't get it. But we do. It says, you men of Israel, hear these words. Jesus of Nazareth, a man approved of God among you by miracles and wonders and signs, which God did by Him in the midst of you, as you yourselves also know, Him being delivered. Now see, He was delivered to the cross. But who delivered Him there? He was delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God. That is, God planned it. God delivered Him to Calvary. But you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. So the fact of the matter is that God planned and created the world. God sustains the world and God rules the world by His own governing hand. And His decreative will is always done in all things. That's what the Bible says. This is our biblical understanding of things. This is the Bible perspective. And therefore, we are not predisposed against the concept of predestination. In fact, we're very open to it by our faith in these great biblical fundamentals. Let me just say here that this is why consistent exposure to the Word of God from week to week in our church meetings is so important. The foundation of Bible fundamentals allows us then to tackle the deeper matters with a good bit more understanding, as opposed to those who have no solid Bible foundation. So hopefully, with our foundation laid over many years, we are ready to take a closer look at this doctrine of predestination. Now, in my opinion, it is not a difficult matter intellectually. It actually is quite simple. God has a plan for His creation, and by His infinite knowledge and wisdom and power, He works and brings His plan to pass in every detail. This is not a hard concept intellectually. In fact, we also make our plans and we try to bring them to pass, don't we? It's just the way we live. Sonia and I planned to come to church this morning. And we went to bed with a plan as to what time to get up. and what time to leave for church. And during the week, I planned out my sermon. And look, I was able to accomplish my plan. I was able to bring my plan to pass. You might say that I predestined these things to come to pass. And because God is infinitely equipped with knowledge and wisdom and power, He is able to perfectly bring His plan to pass day by day. So let's begin by establishing first that the Bible teaches that God has a plan and works to bring His plan to pass. Now, when we say that God planned the world, I think it is best to think of it as being one plan. God doesn't have a set of plans. He doesn't have contingency plans in case things go wrong. Contingency plans are backup plans in case something goes wrong. And contingency plans imply that you might not be able to bring your best plan to pass. Because you and I do not have infinite knowledge and wisdom and power, we have contingency plans. I planned to leave a little early this morning and take my car to go pick up Ellie. You can see she's not here this morning. When I texted her, she said she could not make it today, so I changed my plan. I did not drive to Collierville. But not so with God. There are no contingency plans with God. God issues an order that His plan will be carried out in perfect detail. We call that His decree. And when God issues the order, it shall be done. The fact that God has one plan which He orders to be executed in perfect detail excludes the implication of any other possible alternative courses for the world in the mind of God. And there is no arbitrariness or hesitancy on God's part. His plan is as good as accomplished from all eternity. I want to just take you a few places in the Scriptures this morning which enforce this idea that God has an irrevocable and certain plan. Turn back to Isaiah, if you will. Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 24. It says there, "The Lord of hosts hath sworn, saying, surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass. And as I have purposed, so shall it stand." In this particular context, Isaiah was reassuring the people that God had a plan to deal with the Assyrians and that His plan would surely come to pass. You'll notice in this verse that this plan of God was called God's thought, and it was called God's purpose. And this is a very awesome thing, you see. If God thinks it, it is as good as done. If God thinks to create a universe, then it surely will come to pass. If God purposes something, you might as well count it as done, because it shall come to pass. We're still in Isaiah chapter 14. Look at verse 27. It says in verse 27, "For the Lord of hosts hath" what? "Purposed." That's His plan. "And who shall disannul it? And His hand is stretched out. And who shall turn it back?" I want you to notice the two things that God does in this verse, verse 27. He purposes, and He stretches out His hand. The idea is that God makes a plan, and then He stretches out His hand to work His plan. And who is big enough to stop God from accomplishing all of His good pleasure? Flip over to Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4 and verse 35. And it says there, "And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his" what? "His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou?" Notice again that God has a will and he executes his will. He doeth, it says, according to his will. So this is really the simple concept of predestination. God has a plan, and he powerfully works that plan to bring it to pass. Take a look at Isaiah 46. Isaiah 46, verses 9 through 11. "Remember the former things of old, for I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure, calling a ravenous bird from the east, the man that executeth my counsel from a far country. Yea, my counsel shall stand, and I will" what? "Do." I will do all of my pleasure. So we have the same concept in these verses. God has a plan and he works it to completion. Notice the reference here in Isaiah 46, 9 through 11. Notice the reference to God's plan in these verses. In verses 10 and 11, his plan is referred to by three different words. You have his counsel in verses 10 and 11. You have his pleasure in verse 10. And you have his purpose in verse 11. And then we see that when God has a plan, he also does the work to bring it to pass. It says, "My counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. I have spoken it, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it." Now, when God has a plan, and when he stretches out his strong arm and works his plan, then we find the perfect accomplishment of God's plan is certain. You see, if God has a plan and he's going to do his plan, then it's absolutely certain that these things shall be done. I want you to look at the certainty here. We're still in Isaiah 46, 9 through 11. Look at the certainty. "Declaring the end from the beginning." That's what God does. How can he do it? Because he planned it and he decreed it and he's going to work it. That's how he knows the end from the beginning. "And from ancient times, the things that are not yet done." So when God has a plan, the various elements of that plan are as good as done. You might call it predestination. God planned for his son to be slain for sinners. And that is why Jesus is said to be the lamb slain from the foundation of the world. Revelation 13:8. You might put it this way. Christ was predestined by the determinate counsel of God to be crucified for sinners. And just as God planned it, it came to pass. Once again, in Acts 2, that we read a moment ago, it says, "Him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain." You'll notice that the counsel of God here is called the determinate counsel of God. Don't overlook that word, determinate. It is the counsel of God, that is the plan of God, that was determined to be done. And since it was determined to be done in eternity past, You might say it was predetermined or predestined. See how predestination is such a simple thing with God. He makes a plan and then he powerfully and perfectly works his plan to completion. When I ask you this question this morning, who really delivered Christ to the cross? Was it Caiaphas, that wicked high priest, that really did it? Was it really Pontius Pilate, who found no fault in Jesus and yet turned him over to be executed anyway? Was it wicked men who dragged Jesus up the hill? Or was it God who by his decreative will delivered Jesus there? Our verse says it was God who delivered him there. We're considering the scriptural evidence that God has a plan and that God works his plan to a certain completion. And we've considered several Old Testament passages, but now let's move to the New Testament and see what it has to say about this great concept. Go back to Ephesians 1:11. Ephesians 1:11, it says, "In whom we also have obtained an inheritance, being," what's the next word? "Predestinated according to the purpose of him who," what? "Worketh all things after the counsel of his own will." In speaking about our salvation here, Paul comes right out and says, our salvation was predestinated. That is, it was determined to be done beforehand. But notice the two necessary elements of predestination found in this verse. It was purposed, and then it was worked. You have the will of God from all eternity, and then the work of God in the course of time to bring His will to pass. Now, if we made this into a mathematical formula, it would look like this. And I had Brother David bring my board out. Thank you, Brother David, for that. I always liked mathematics in school. I was going to be a math teacher at one time when I was taking my calculus class. That didn't work out because the Lord soon called me to preach. But I'm going to preach mathematics. So here we go. Here's the mathematical formula. First of all, God has a plan, right? It's His counsel. It's His purpose. It's His will. It's His thought. It's what He wants. So God has a plan. And then if you add to that, God's work. God's plan plus God's work equals certain accomplishment. That's not so complicated, is it? That's an easy mathematical formula. God's plan plus God's work equals certain accomplishment. So in terms of Romans 8:29 and 30... first of all, we see the plan, you see. He foreknew. That is, before the world began, He chose a people to be like Christ. This is what He wanted. He wanted a people. He wanted a people to honor Him and to share in His glory and to be a brother for His Son, Christ. That's what He wanted. And He chose a people. This was the plan. It was a glorious plan. It was a very gracious plan. It was the plan to miraculously change sinners into saints. It was the plan to save sinners by forgiving their sins while protecting the just character of God. But you'll notice from our text that the mere existence of a plan does not get the job done. But it requires action to bring the plan to pass. So Paul is instructing us here that God didn't stop with just the plan. Rather, God went on and performed the work to bring His plan to pass. Look at Romans 8:30. Moreover, whom He did predestinate, them He also called. You notice, God is going on now and doing the work. And whom He called, He also justified. And whom He justified, He also glorified. Of course, Paul only gives us some of the highlights of God's work. Why, it would take a long, long time to describe all of God's work that He does in the salvation process. God did many things to effectively save us. He worked all the circumstances which led to the atoning work of Christ, you see. Who's to say that Christ would have ever been crucified? Who knows what men would have done? If they had had their way, they'd have killed Him much earlier than the cross. But all of God's providences led Christ to the cross, you see. He worked it so that an atonement was made for us. He worked in our lives by many providences to bring us to Christ. Perhaps He gave us a godly father or a godly mother. I don't know. God works in many ways. Perhaps He took us through much trouble to break our hearts and make us ready for Christ. And then, of course, in due time, He made us alive spiritually by His Holy Spirit. And on it goes. God does a massive work to bring each of His elect into a saving knowledge of Christ. So in our text, we see His plan to save, and then we see His work which saves. And because God is omniscient and omnipotent, His work perfectly accomplishes His plan. And so you see how when God plans something, it is said to be predestined. What a God we have who has no weakness and no lack of resources to perfectly accomplish His most difficult purposes. I'd like to conclude this morning by encouraging you in this great doctrine of predestination. It is not an ugly doctrine. It is a most glorious doctrine. It is not a doctrine to be hidden from the church. It is a doctrine to be preached in the church with great passion and joy. The doctrine of predestination is a doctrine which meshes perfectly with the infinite attributes of God. If God is an all-knowing God, and if God is an all-powerful God, and if God is a sovereign God, and if God is in control of all things, and if God knows the end from the beginning, then it must be that He has made a plan. And He has decreed that this plan will be carried out in every respect. It must be that our God is a predestinating God. Now, we're going to talk more about predestination, I think, next week. There are issues that come up because of this. What about human responsibility, you see? We'll talk some about that. But let it be known that it doesn't remove our human responsibility. It's side by side with it. And we'll talk about some of that next week, okay?